Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dave Graham. I'm the Executive Director of the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School, U.S. Army. Most of you know that we're a neighbor of the law school, right across the street. And in my capacity as the Executive Director, I'm very pleased to join with the John Bassett Moore Society of International Law and the UVA Law Human Rights Program in welcoming you to this afternoon's panel presentation, the title of which is Extraordinary Rendition, Issues of Law and Policy. Now, having said that, let me tell you that I am flattered by the fact that I was given equal billing in the publicity surrounding this event, but I am here exclusively in the role of moderator. I realize fully that you're here to hear the two experts on this subject, and therefore I'll proceed accordingly. I'm going to introduce our panelists in a few minutes, and they're going to take 15 to 20 minutes each, and then we'll afford you ample time to ask questions. Now, having said that, I have been asked as the moderator to at least make some introductory comments with respect to framing the issues from a legal perspective, i.e. the applicable international and U.S. domestic law relevant to this thing that we call extraordinary rendition. And I will do that and hopefully tee up some issues that the panelists might like to discuss in greater detail later on. So having said that, I think we all understand that suspected terrorist, and I'm going to use the term terrorist here because I think terrorists are the individuals that are probably more likely to find themselves on the receiving end of extraordinary rendition as we approach this topic in the context of this thing that we call the, quote, global war on terrorism. So we'll talk about terrorists, and I think we understand that suspected terrorists are often transferred from one state to another for the purpose of arrest, detention, and or interrogation. And this act of transfer itself is an act of rendition. And I say that so that you don't go away, don't take away the idea that the word rendition is in and of itself a dirty word. It's not. When a transfer or rendition is accomplished through a formal judicial legal process in the United States, generally pursuant to a treaty, we call this what? We call this extradition. A fully legal process subject to judicial challenge by the individual concerned. Now, when such transfers are effectuated through a process, an extrajudicial process, they're referred to as extraordinary or irregular renditions. And when this is accomplished, there is, in fact, no judicial challenge to such a transfer. The legal process is not available. And when the individuals are transferred using this process, they're often transferred from the territory of the rendering state, or they may possibly be transferred from the territory of a third state, where they are seized and then transported directly to still another state. And in this latter situation, this transfer may in fact occur with the informed consent of the state affected, or it may and often is effectuated without the consent of that state. Now, just as I indicated with respect to rendition not being a dirty word, having talked about extrajudicial process and transfer, let me note that extrajudicial transfer is in and of itself, in fact, not necessarily an unlawful transfer. Okay? Now, the recent controversy surrounding extraordinary rendition arises from the use of renditions to transfer suspected terrorists to countries known to employ exceptionally harsh interrogation methods, methods that may, in fact, rise to the level of torture, methods prohibited by U.S. law, and yet methods that are used purportedly by the countries to which these renditions are made, it is said with the knowledge and acquiescence of the United States, thus the charge. The United States, in engaging in extraordinary renditions, is in fact simply contracting out torture for the purpose of gaining an intelligence information that cannot be gained under U.S. law. And there have been any number of reports, none of which have been substantiated, that since 9/11, over 100 extraordinary renditions have occurred. The Bush administration has said that They do not engage in extraordinary rendition for the purpose of rendering people for intelligence interrogation using torture as a method. They don't deny that extraordinary renditions have occurred, but certainly they do deny that the transfers are effectuated for the purpose of engaging in torture on that end for the purpose of intelligence information. As a matter of fact, President Bush made the statement of 16th March 2005, almost a year ago. He said, prior to engaging in renditions of this nature, i.e. extraordinary renditions, the United States always receives a very specific promise from the state to which these individuals are transferred that such individuals will not be tortured. Now, having said that with some as background, let's take a look at the international and U.S. law relevant to extraordinary renditions. And far and away, the long pole in the tent with respect to extraordinary rendition from an international law standpoint is the 1984 UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, fortunately known by the acronym of CAT. Okay? The United States ratified CAT in 1994 with a very specific treaty understanding that CAT was not self-executing. That means that we have to have implementing U.S. legislation. I want to cover, for our panelists, frame the legal issues anyway. I want to cover four specific articles of CAT, Articles 2, 3, 4, and 5, very briefly, and give you the basis of what these articles are. Article 2.2 of the CAT states that no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, and here perhaps we're talking about Article 3 conflicts as we understand them under the 49 Geneva Conventions, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification of torture. Article 3 of CAT, a very important provision of the Convention Against Torture, prohibits the transfer of persons to countries where there is a substantial likelihood, a term of art here, substantial likelihood. This is interpreted by the United States to mean it's more likely than not that the individuals rendered will be tortured. Now, having said that, let me add this caveat. There are, in fact, many forms of persecutions to include very harsh interrogation methods that, though considered cruel and unusual under U.S. law, the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, do not necessarily constitute torture as torture is understood under the Convention Against Torture. And the CAT does not prohibit the transfer of individuals in such cases. In fact, the United States State Department, in making its analysis of CAT in 1988, leading up to the ratification of CAT, had this to say, and it may surprise you. Rough treatment, it said, even though falling into the category of police brutality, while deplorable, does not amount to torture for CAT purposes. And I would add, and I think this is a very important element of it, I would note that while the CAT does obligate parties to take measures to prevent other acts of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment that falls short of torture, this obligation to prevent, the obligation to prevent, extends only to acts occurring within that state's own territory. That's an important provision. Keep that in mind. Let's take a look at the U.S. implementation of CAT, specifically Article 3. This occurs in the form of Public Law 105-277, 1998. It says, it's U.S. policy not to expel, extradite, or otherwise affect, this is important now, the involuntary return of any person to a country in which there are substantial grounds to believe that the person would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Again, important language, regardless of whether the person is physically present in the United States. This raises two issues. The first language, the involuntary return of any person to a country. Does this mean that the individual in issue had to have originally been present in the country to which he is now being returned? The second issue, dependent upon that language, excuse me, regardless of whether the person is physically present in the United States, this seems to mean that this prohibition applies to individuals seized in third countries as well. However, having said this, I will tell you that the U.S. regulations implementing CAT Article 3 do permit the consideration of what we call diplomatic assurances. We consider these in making removal and extradition decisions, and therefore, arguably, we make these also in making rendition decisions. And CAT Article 3 provides very little guidance as to the application of diplomatic assurances to rendition decisions. Now, U.S. implementation of Articles 4 and 5 of CAT. Article 4 requires signatory states to criminalize all instances of torture, as well as complicity or participation in torture. That is, the conspiracy to commit torture. Article 5 details the minimal jurisdictional measures a state must adopt. Now, the U.S. criminalization of torture occurs in the form of 18 U.S.C. 2340 and 2348. It criminalizes torture as well as conspiracy to torture outside the United States. Outside the United States. In terms of U.S. jurisdiction occurs when the alleged offender is either a U.S. national or is present in the United States, regardless of the nationality of either the offender or the victim. Let's take a very brief look at the application of CAT and the U.S. implementing legislation to extraordinary renditions based on our covering of the articles that we just spoke to. Let's take a look first at renditions from the United States. Here, Article 3 of CAT clearly prohibits, as we've seen, the rendition of persons from the territory of a signatory state to another state when there are substantial grounds to believe the person would be tortured. But if the U.S. has received diplomatic assurances that a person would not be tortured if rendered, and these assurances are deemed credible, the rendition would not appear, on its face at least, to violate either Article 3 or the U.S. implementing legislation. And neither CAT nor the U.S. legislation prohibit the U.S. from rendering individuals to states where they might face harsh treatment, including treatment that would be prohibited under U.S. law, if such treatment doesn't rise to the level of torture. In other words, it could be cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, but it doesn't rise to the level of torture. Now, renditions from outside the United States. There's some interesting arguments associated with renditions from outside the United States. It has, in fact, been argued that the CAT does not apply to certain actions taken by signatories outside of territories under their jurisdiction. That is, when they seize individuals in a third country and directly render them to another country, CAT simply doesn't apply. While Article 3 clearly limits renditions from the U.S., it is not completely certain as to the extent to which CAT applies to situations of third country seizures. A more comprehensive argument along these lines would tell you that protections afforded under CAT or any other human rights agreement simply have no extraterritorial application. There are some very fairly complex and sometimes sophisticated legal arguments associated with this. I'm not going to get into them. Perhaps the panel members would like to do that. Criminal sanctions for participation in torture. And here, obviously, we're concerned about a U.S. official who sanctions the rendering of an individual to another country. Is that U.S. official subject to being prosecuted criminally? And I suppose the answer would be if he sanctions a rendering and he understands fully that torture will occur or directs that torture is going to occur, he's subject to criminal prosecution under 2340. Yet if he simply sanctions a rendering to a country that has promised that torture would not occur, and even if cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment occurs, I would argue that that individual probably cannot be successfully prosecuted. Now, very briefly, let me just touch upon some other treaties other than the CAT and statutes that might affect extraordinary rendition. The first of these is the 1949 Geneva Conventions. There are very specific provisions in each of the 49 Geneva Conventions that have a relevancy to this issue of extraordinary rendition. Secondly, the War Crimes Act, 18 U.S.C. 2441. Third, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights of 1966, specifically Article 7 of that covenant, The U.S. has said that this is not a self-executing covenant. The United States hasn't passed any implementing legislation with respect to this particular covenant. And then lastly, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. We understand that that's not a treaty. It has no enforcement provisions. Okay, let me leave you and our panel members with these two final thoughts, perhaps framed in the form of questions. While it would appear, based on what we've said in the last 10 minutes, that a state cannot effect extraordinary rendition for the specific purpose of torture, in order to gain information, it would also appear that such renditions can occur if a state receives credible diplomatic assurances that an individual will not be tortured while in its custody. And so that begs the question, what then is the purpose of the United States for engaging in such renditions? Well, maybe the answer to that is in the form of the second issue that I would put on the table. While a state may provide diplomatic assurances that it will not torture a rendered suspected terrorist, we now understand, I think, that it can engage in many harsh interrogation techniques that, while in violation of U.S. law, the 5th, the 8th, the 14th Amendment, they do not rise to the level of torture. They may be said, they may be cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Perhaps this is the answer to why extraordinary renditions have occurred. Okay, with that as background, perhaps more background than you wanted, let me introduce our first panelist this afternoon, and that's Professor Margaret Sadovoy. She is the co-director of the International Human Rights Clinic and is a faculty director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at the New York University School of Law. She graduated magna cum laude from NYU in 1999 as clerk for the Ninth Circuit and has also clerked for the International Court of Justice in 2001-2002. She came to NYU in 2003 after working for Human Rights First and the UN Development Fund for Women. Her research, interestingly enough, focuses on human rights abuses and the war on terror, the law of transfer and migration, and the extraterritorial application of human rights law, all areas of interest that deal directly with the subject that we're discussing this afternoon, extraordinary rendition. Under her direction, the clinic published with the New York City Bar Association the first comprehensive report on the issue of extraordinary renditions entitled Torture by Proxy. Her current project is an article-length consideration of extraordinary rendition as a limit case for human rights law. She frequently consults with UN agencies, serves on the board of directors of Amnesty International, USA, as a member of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association. So, Professor, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here, and I really appreciate your introductory remarks. In fact, they sort of set up exactly what I had intended to talk about, and will potentially cut down my remarks, which I think would be useful so that we can actually have a conversation. So thank you very much.
Sure.
So the first thing I wanted to talk about was actually making the distinction between rendition and extraordinary rendition, and that may be one place where we're going to differ, at least in the sense of I believe we actually need a category that's called extraordinary rendition for the sake of at least our discussion. So I would agree completely with the definition of rendition, meaning an extra legal transfer or an extra judicial transfer. And I'm using the term extra legal as opposed to illegal for the same purpose to indicate that there's no judicial process involved. So it's an informal transfer. So what then is an extraordinary rendition if I'm insisting that there's a difference? The difference for the sake of our conversation is that an extraordinary rendition involves a transfer in the face of a risk of torture. And when we prepared our report on rendition, the reason we created this definition was so that we could analyze it as an analytical category and talk about a set of transfers that had started to happen in the wake of 9/11. So the second thing to say is, where did this form of extraordinary rendition come from? And the basic answer, at least so far as those of us on the outside can tell, is that it's a change from something that used to be called rendition to justice into something that I'm calling extraordinary rendition. Rendition to justice was a policy that was put in place apparently during the Reagan era, in which suspected terrorists were abducted or seized outside of the United States and rendered back to the United States to face charges and usually to face actual trial. I'm going to call that rendition to justice because that's what it's been called in the press and in the literature and in some of the declassified directives that we've been able to look at. So what happened in the transformation from rendition to justice to the apparent construction of a category or a practice extraordinary rendition? Well, that's the $20 million question, of course. And to start, to sort of start with that question, I'm going to take four of the answers that we've heard in the press and that we've heard from the Bush administration about what is extraordinary rendition and or how is it used. So the first answer is it doesn't exist. It's actually all just rendition. So basically what we're talking about there is some answers that we've gotten. We had a fantastic example of an explanation by President Bush about diplomatic assurances. Another common answer is the one that Secretary of State Rice gave when she went to Europe recently and was repeatedly asked about this extraordinary rendition process. What she said was, actually, we're doing what we've done for many years. We're rendering suspected terrorists. And she referred explicitly to a set of cases in which people had been rendered to justice. Now, is there something else going on, is the question. And unfortunately, the only answers we have are very circumstantial. We have a lot of off-the-record statements from unnamed CIA agents, from unnamed government officials. So just to give a few examples of those, of what they've said, the first thing that has been stated is that there was a September 17th, 2001 presidential directive, which is often talked about currently in the context of both rendition and these secret black sites. And apparently that directive authorized the CIA and other agencies to kill, capture, or detain high-value al-Qaeda suspects. Apparently, we don't know the contours of the program at this point. There's a lot of allegations in the press about the numbers. Colonel Graham referred to some of the numbers that have been thrown around. I personally have not ever heard a very convincing number analysis because it depends on how you're defining this category, of course. But the idea is that we're not aiming at transferring people to torture, we're aiming at transferring people to interrogation, and we're trying to get actionable intelligence, of course. One piece of evidence that I think is very interesting for us to consider that has emerged was a leaked memo from a supervisory special agent of the FBI who's talking about a transfer from Guantanamo. Now that's obviously potentially a different legal category for a variety of the reasons that were already mentioned, the status of the territory, who's on Guantanamo, et cetera. But what happened here was that an FBI agent wrote to his superiors in 2002 warning them that there was a particular form of interrogation that he was very concerned about. He called it Category 4, and those of you who followed all of the debates, investigations, and discussion of the different levels and types of interrogation being used will recognize Categories 1 through 3 as a category that's been discussed a lot. Category 4, he called, he described it as followed. Detainee will be sent off Gitmo, either temporarily or permanently, to Jordan, Egypt, or another third country to allow those countries to employ interrogation techniques that will enable them to obtain the requisite information. Okay, so what we have there is at least the missing link of the intent to have certain kinds of interrogation techniques employed. It's not clear exactly what we mean, what those are, but certainly including the countries Jordan, Egypt, and another third country implies that there's a certain set of interrogation techniques that are used there that we all know about, certainly from the Department of State's human rights record, which would include both CID treatment and torture. So what we have there, I think, is helpful, but again, only really impressionistic. It does give the sense that, yes, there is some kind of intent to use or to at least harness the capacity to have another set of interrogation techniques utilized that the U.S. government is not willing to use itself. What is really striking here, of course, also is that the FBI agent was concerned about the not only the authorizing process for this Category 4, but also potentially criminal liability, and he was particularly concerned about the torture statute. And so he was writing and saying, we have to be careful that we are not involved in this. So that's sort of answer number one to the denial, that there's clearly some category, there's some type of technique going on here that's different than rendition to justice. There's rendition to some form of interrogation techniques in another country intentionally. Okay, so then the second sort of form of denial is the exact second one that Colonel Graham actually mentioned, which is that human rights treaties don't apply extraterritorially, right? So the specific issue at hand is to look at both the norm of the norm or prohibition on the use of torture, and then the norm against transfer to risk of torture, which is refoulement. And it's important here to notice the norm is actually about transfer to the risk of torture. It's not about transfer to torture. So it doesn't actually matter if torture occurs after the transfer to determine whether the norm has been breached or not. What matters is the knowing transfer to a risk of torture. And of course, it's a specific level of risk that the U.S. has codified and that the treaty has that are two separate norms. So what does this norm actually apply extraterritorially if we're talking about the non-refoulement norm? Now, what the Torture Convention actually says is as follows. No state party shall expel, return, refouler, or extradite a person to another state where there are substantial grounds for believing that he would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Okay, so if you go back to the travaux préparatoires, which are the negotiating history of the treaty, it's apparent that the geographic reach of this norm actually wasn't an issue. There wasn't a big debate over whether this should apply extraterritorially or not. What they were concerned about, the states that were negotiating the treaty, was ensuring that all of the different types of transfer were included in this article, which is why there's sort of a set of types of transfer listed here. The original draft only included reference to expulsion and refoulement. And those were the ones that, of course, had been of grave concern coming out of World War II. But what ended up happening was a discussion in which the drafters decided to add these other categories to ensure that they covered all types of transfer. So then how do we deal with the fact that there's no scope of application specified in Article 3? I would argue, without having a lot of time to make a long legal analysis, that the best approach is to follow the rules concerning extraterritorial application of human rights conventions in general. And human rights bodies have developed two main types of doctrine for determining the extraterritorial application when that's triggered. The first one is a very classic international law rule, which says, whenever there is territory that's under the effective control of a state, the human rights treaty norms actually follow and apply. The second rule is where an individual person is under the physical control of an agent of the state, the norms apply there. So what would this mean if we were going to use those rules with Article 3? Well, under the effective control of territory test, Article 3 would then apply to transfers that take place from the U.S., of course, and then also from spaces that are U.S.-like under international law, which would include the space of Guantanamo, for example, or other spaces that are clearly under our effective control. But those would be a very limited set of spaces. The personal control doctrine, on the other hand, would allow us to capture or to follow any agent who had someone under their physical custody and control. And that would mean that Article 3 would then apply to any transfer out of the physical custody of a U.S. agent. Now, what has the U.S. done? We've already mentioned FARA, the implementing act for CAT Article 3, and we've already heard that there was a statement of policy that said the U.S. will not expel, extradite, or otherwise affect the involuntary return of any person to a country in which there are substantial grounds for believing the person would be in danger of being subjected to torture, regardless of whether the person is physically present in the U.S. Now, that policy statement was followed by an instruction to relevant agencies to implement regulations that would allow them to implement that policy directive. The agencies that are involved in extraterritorial transfers, especially the Department of Defense, the FBI, and the CIA, to our knowledge, have not promulgated implementing regulations, indicating that they probably don't believe they were the relevant agencies for the purpose of implementing this policy directive. So we're sort of left with a gap there and a question. Is that, what did Congress mean when it implemented that? And there's actually legislation right now that's been introduced on each side, in the House by Representative Markey, in the Senate by Senator Leahy, which attempt to close the gap and say that we have to implement Article 3 extraterritorially as well. But they clearly believe that there may have been a gap. So that's something for discussion. The next response has, of course, been that we use diplomatic assurances, and the diplomatic assurances actually allow us to transfer people by obviating the risk of torture. So the first thing it does is taking away or lowering the risk of torture, which would bring the U.S. then into compliance with non-refoulement rule. The second point is that this would negate any kind of mens rea around conspiracy to torture, intent to torture, because you would have a diplomatic assurance saying that we will not torture. I would argue that both of these arguments fail with diplomatic assurances. They actually haven't been shown to reduce the risk of torture in a reliable way. And there's a couple major problems with diplomatic assurances. One, they're generally negotiated completely in private, but quietly and diplomatically, like any diplomatic process. They're not open to the public. They are not, of course, judicially enforceable, as far as we know, although there is a Ninth Circuit case that indicates that potentially on habeas, someone facing extradition may be able to get review, but it's never been actually decided on the merits. And secondly, the whole context in which a diplomatic assurance arises is when there is a known risk of torture. So you're actually asking a state which is known to have a practice of torture to promise not to do that. Now, there's a significant number of problems with that. One, it's a question of good faith. Can you really trust that promise? And two, in a state where torture is systematic, does the diplomatic agent actually have the requisite control to make sure that that form of torture does not actually occur despite their promise? So those are both, I think, significant problems with diplomatic assurances. Another set of problems arises from, again, statements that have come through the press that are attributed to security officials who have said basically, look, we use these assurances, but they're kind of a wink and a nod, and we know that they're not going to be honored in good faith. So that raises a number of problems about our intent as well, and whether we actually are intending to ensure that torture is not used, or potentially that there is this attempt to carve out CID from torture. So that's a significant problem that I don't think is answered, has been answered by the Bush administration. Another piece of that analysis or argument has come from an Arab diplomat who was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, well, you know, look, we know that when they ask us to make these promises, quote, it's really more like don't ask, don't tell. So there's potentially an understanding on the other side as well that these are not real promises. The final argument that has been brought up is one that we've had out in the open a lot in the last couple weeks, which is an argument about the president's power. Echoing arguments concerning the recent revelations of the warrantless NSA wiretapping program, this argument says that the president, through his commander-in-chief power, has the ability to contravene the torture convention or the other conventions that we've ratified, which might be relevant, and in addition, also has the ability to contravene potential statutory requirements like FARA if we do accept that it applies extraterritorially. So the most sort of vociferous or forceful arguments here have been laid out by John Yoo, just like in the, some of the other torture contexts. And basically, his argument is that the commander-in-chief authority, when combined with the authorization for the use of military force that was passed by Congress, actually allows the president to go ahead and contravene these other potential constricting authorities. There's significant problems here. The first one is that John Yoo just sort of dismisses the Geneva Conventions, not only the Torture Convention, but also the Geneva Conventions, saying that, just as we have heard many times, that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are completely ineligible for any protection under the Geneva Conventions, which I won't take on here because there's obviously enough analysis of that running around. And the second piece is that a good way to analyze this question is to look at what the Supreme Court said in Hamdi, where they said essentially the authorization for the use of military force gave the president the power to do whatever is fundamental, or is whatever counts as a fundamental incident of waging war. So that's what the commander-in-chief power means, and that's what we would have to then ask, okay, is extraordinary rendition a fundamental incident of waging war? I would argue it's not, and I think there are a number of reasons why. We could look at the Geneva Conventions that would be relevant in determining that. And I think the second reason, which is potentially a more interesting conversation, is whether the Geneva Conventions are the right regime to be looking to here, given that we're talking about, at least the transfers I'm talking about, are ones that take place very far from any kind of battlefield. So we're talking about an imam who's abducted in Milan and sent to Egypt, or a student who's picked up in Pakistan and deposited in Jordan, or the famous case of Maher Arar, who's taken from JFK and sent to Syria. So I don't think that the Geneva Conventions are necessarily the right regime to be looking to. So those are the sort of main arguments and my opening comments for discussion, and I would look forward to more of an exchange, and I will stop here. Thank you again for inviting me.
Okay, well, thank you. And I will force myself to stick to the topic and not get into the area of the unitary executive, which I have strong feelings about, but nevertheless, this is not the appropriate forum for it because we're dealing with extraordinary renditions. Our next speaker is Michael Schur, who has assured me that if you have come to him for a legal analysis, you have come to the wrong place. He is going to be talking to us, coming at it from a different angle, perhaps introducing us to a dose of reality, as opposed to a clinical legal analysis of this situation. He's the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, Imperial Hubris. Published anonymously originally, as required by the Central Intelligence Agency. He's the former head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, who resigned in November 2004 after nearly two decades of experience in national security issues related to Afghanistan, South Asia, and the Middle East. As anonymous, he is also the author of Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama Bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America. His writings have appeared in The Atlantic, Washington Times, Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, the Dallas Morning News, and the Washington Post. He's been featured on Meet the Press, Nightline, 60 Minutes, The News Hour, and any number of international television news programs as well. He's been interviewed extensively for broadcast media and documentaries, to include National Geographic, the Discovery Channel. He's been the focus of print media worldwide. He holds a BA, an MA, two MAs and a PhD. Your universities aren't listed, Michael, so I'm assuming that's still covert.
No, sir.
In nature.
Not at all. Just not listed.
And he's an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University, so we're very happy to have you with us.
Okay? Thank you for having me. I need to stress that I was a practitioner of renditions. And I have to say, I'd never heard I set up the first rendition program in 1995. And I never heard the word extraordinary attached to rendition until the media began to use it after I resigned in November of 2004. As far as I know, it was never used within the agency. And that's another point I need to make up front. There are different kinds of moving people around the world. I can only speak to my own experience, and that's with the CIA. I don't know what the FBI does in any area of their activities, or or what DOD does in moving people. I thought I would tell you kind of the background from which the rendition program flowed, how we conducted it, why we conducted it, and where it stands today. The rendition program really flowed after flowed out of the diaspora of Sunni militant fighters after the end of the war in Afghanistan in 1992. We began to follow them around the world, and they turned out to be a hardy breed and people who were expert at blending into populations. We also began to look at the Sunni militants because of the proliferation of Osama bin Laden's name, in the early 90s. Not as someone who was running some kind of an international organization, but someone whose name came up whenever we dealt with Sunni fighters who needed documents or guns or a job or a safe house or some kind of an instruction course. The third thing that put us onto the problem was the effectiveness of Sunni fighters in the Balkans, in Kashmir, and in Chechnya and Tajikistan after the Afghan war. We were also struck by the concentration of multiple Sunni groups in Khartoum, Sudan. And so that was really the basis of what moved the U.S. government toward wanting to take action against the Sunni militants. In 1995, the National Security Council, at that time Anthony Lake, his deputy was Sandy Berger, and Richard Clark, decided they wanted to do something about terrorism. They weren't quite sure. The natural inclination would have been to destroy the proliferation of Sunni-related training camps around the world in places like Somalia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Sudan, Kashmir, and other places, but they didn't want to do that. So Lake was intrigued by terrorist financing, and so he told us to go after Osama bin Laden. I think people tend to forget that the CIA, the clandestine service especially, is a service organization. We get told what to do, and we do it, and more often than not, we do fairly well. And at that time, for the National Security Council, the CIA was the only game in town. The Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted nothing to do with terrorism, and the FBI did not care a lick about this particular problem, and as you recall, Judge Free and the President weren't speaking. The first terrorist we rendered, if you will, was out of the Balkans in late 1995, a senior member of the terrorist group, the Egyptian Jamaat al-Islamiyya, the Islamic group of Egypt. In 1996, Lake again asked us to set up a unit specifically devoted to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. By late 1996, we had developed intelligence that showed al-Qaeda was unlike any other terrorist group that we had ever seen in terms of its organization, size, lethality, and geographic reach. Berger and Clark and Lake at that time told the CIA to begin breaking up al-Qaeda cells around the world and taking al-Qaeda fighters off the street. We said, "Yes, sir, what do you want done with these people?" They said, "Well, that's up to you." And we said, "No, sir, you don't understand. We're not jailers. We don't want them. We don't have any place to put them." They said, "Well, that's up to you." So with that guidance, between 1997 and 9/11, we created a list of senior al-Qaeda leaders and their Egyptian allies from the Islamic group and from Zawahiri's Egyptian Islamic Jihad to attack. An attack meant causing them to be incarcerated somewhere. There were only two goals in the rendition program. The first was to incarcerate someone who was dangerous to the United States. The second was to grab whatever papers he had on him at the time of his arrest, whether they were a hard copy or electronic material up from a hard drive, a Palm Pilot, whatever, because that was information they had never expected the Americans to read. Anything else we got after that was gravy. There was almost no attention paid at that time to interrogation. Al-Qaeda fighters and their allies are trained to either fabricate or to provide you a great deal of very accurate information that's dated, and you spend a lot of time chasing your tail and it ends up leading you nowhere. And the third point I would make is that all of these kids come out of police states. They're very used to being interrogated, and they're very used to misleading you. So that we created the list. The only really two goals we had were to incarcerate and to grab the papers. Then we needed to locate a fighter, an Al-Qaeda fighter, an Egyptian fighter, in a country that was willing to work with us to arrest him. I should make clear that in so far as I know, through November 2004, the CIA never seized anyone. All people that were rendered were arrested by local services. A fighter had to be located in a country willing to work with us in terms of arresting him. That ruled out most of the world. The Europeans were useless. Most of Southeast Asia was useless. We had some good luck in Africa and the Balkans. Then we had to find a country to which you could take the captured fighter. Generally, countries will only take their own nationals. So it turned out what the agency's role was primarily brokering an arrangement between the country that did the arrest and the country that was going to do the incarceration, and at times providing the mechanism for moving a person from one country to another. Just to give you an idea of what kind of information was needed, we had to prepare a sheet, a package of information based on intelligence information about what the individual was responsible for, had been involved in, or was planning. That material was then reviewed by the core of agency lawyers, lawyers at the National Security Council, and lawyers at the Department of Justice. No operation was conducted without the approval of those lawyers. And I need to stress, we repeatedly told Berger, who had taken over for Clark, that none of the countries we were taking these people to had sterling records in terms of State Department reporting. There was no, Jimmy Stewart, told Clark one time, never made a movie called Mr. Smith Goes to Cairo. The NSC decision in that regard was they puckered up, they got a little upset, and they said, well, can you ask X country if they will treat these people according to their own laws? And we said, yeah, we're pretty sure we could ask them that, and we're fairly confident that they'll do it. But that doesn't address the issue we've raised with you. And they said, well, it salves our conscience. Proceed. So that's how the system worked. It was a very limited system in the sense that you had to have three moving parts. You had to have a fighter you could identify and prove to a set of lawyers that he was a threat to the United States. You had to have him in a country that was willing to work with you to arrest him. Those countries then wanted him out of the country as quickly as possible, so you had to have a third country to take him to. After 9/11, the process didn't change very much, but there was a greatly increased pressure inside the government to pick up more people. They wanted victories. The one thing that has always amused me is that the Bush administration gets blamed for taking people to countries where they get tortured, and I think some of that may occur, but it happened exclusively. There was no other option under Clinton. For some people in the administration, this administration, they decided it was better for Americans to hold these people because somehow we were smarter than the WAGs and we would ask better questions. And I think that's wrong, but we hold them more, we hold more of them now than we ever did before. We held not one single person under Clinton's administration. I personally think that the Egyptians and the Jordanians and many of the other services we deal with are much smarter than we are in terms of interrogation and debriefings. I'm not sure we do any good at all. Looking back, I think I would argue that the CIA rendition program has been the most successful CT program that the United States government has ever conducted. It is entirely appropriate and an essential practice for the clandestine service of the United States to conduct in the defense of America. It is also appropriate and essential because the FBI is incompetent and the military has other jobs to do. It is, however, scandalous that the rendition program is the main U.S. counterterrorism effort. The enemy we face is so much bigger than the clandestine service can ever hope to handle. And we've known that since 1997, that the rendition program is no more than a prick in the side of Al-Qaeda and the rest of these people. We continue to really believe that these are inferior people who can't beat the Americans, and I'm afraid we're going to pay for that. What was true in 97 is true today. We cannot defeat Al-Qaeda by ourselves. It's too big. It's too powerful. The war can't be won by the CIA and the military alone either. We will lose if we don't kill more of the enemy and effect at least a partial withdrawal from the Middle East. That said, the rendition program can be run more efficiently. We need to recognize that there's a great value to the program. It has been very successful in taking senior Al-Qaeda fighters and Egyptian fighters off the street. And we need to recognize that the only downside of the program has been self-inflicted by the politicians in the last two administrations. Under Clinton, we captured fighters and took them to countries with poor human rights records. Under Bush, we continue to treat these people as criminals and now are holding them incommunicado. These actions by the two administrations have given the Europeans, human rights advocates, and political grandstanders like Senators McCain and Levin a basis to gum up the works for political purposes. All of these factors have and are hampering the rendition program and thereby degrade America's ability to defend itself. The agency's answer to this problem has been all along to treat these people as prisoners of war in no different way than we treated Germans or Japanese during World War II. Bring them to the United States, put them in prison camps as we did our other enemies, let the Red Cross visit them and bring them cookies, you know, let them write to their mamas, do whatever they want, and then hold them until we decide the war is over. The rendition program, as I said, is essential to the United States. It's not a war winner, but it's really the most effective program we have. And in terms of when you look at whether or not people were tortured, I can only say that my experience is that there was no failure on the part of the agency to inform senior leaders in both administrations what would happen to these people if they were taken to Middle Eastern countries. So I would leave it there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael. Meg, do you have any initial response to any of that? Or?
No, I thought it was extremely enlightening, actually. Thank you very much. And I would be interested in hearing you follow up a little bit on your recommendation that the Al-Qaeda fighters be treated as POWs and sort of why that didn't go over well. I think it's very interesting.
Well, under Clinton, they didn't want to go to the Congress and make some kind of an arrangement to find out how we could bring these people to the United States. You know, in some ways, the United States government still works under the delusion that the Cold War exists. We're always looking for proxies to do our dirty work, whether it's the Egyptians taking a rendered fighter or pressing Musharraf to find bin Laden when we won't do it. It's that kind of mindset. And also, it was the easy way out. It was easier for us to pick them up and take them to a Middle Eastern country than to bring them here. And frankly, I have to think that I have some sympathy, because when you do one of these operations, very few foreign governments are going to let an FBI person accompany them to seize an individual. And so if you brought a person to the United States and put him into the U.S. court system, the FBI agent could not swear that he wasn't roughed up or tortured, and he also could not swear that the documents that were seized were not tampered with. And so it's not an easy thing to do if you're going to bring them here as criminals. I think it's easier as prisoners of war.
Okay. Well, I think the macro issue that's still on the table is, can we involve a rendition program, promulgate a rendition program that can be lawful in nature? Is there any way that we can make it lawful in nature? Mr. Shore has indicated, and I think it's fairly persuasive, in the fact that rendition is an essential part of the quote global war on terrorism. Our concern now, and the reason that it's become so controversial in the last few months, is that the American public and a large segment of Congress is convinced that the only reason that we engage in extraordinary renditions is for the purpose of extracting intelligence information that we couldn't extract under U.S. law. Can you make a rendition program effective and lawful at the same time? Do you two have any thoughts on that?
Well, one of the thoughts I do have is that there's obviously a problem of evidence, right? And this is where I think your point about the kind of criminal justice paradigm versus the POW or Geneva Convention paradigm is really important, I think. And I do think that human rights advocates often get out of that question by sort of just saying, well, it's not our problem. But I do think that the whole Article 3 construct and the purpose around asking for judicial process is to keep things within a judicially supervised system whereby people have protections. And so one of the questions I have about whether a rendition process could be legal is not only whether the human rights obligations are being met, which is my number one question, of course, but number two, what is the purpose of the end point? You know, obviously getting people off the street is the first goal, but if we're going to be sending someone somewhere, I would imagine that there needs to be an additional purpose, and that's where the rubber hits the road. Are you talking about a criminal justice paradigm? Are you talking about a sort of prisoner of war armed conflict paradigm?
You can't underestimate the moral cowardice of the people who run our government, and really their stupidity.
Be frank now.
Yeah. You know, both administrations have made the point that, well, we can't treat them as prisoners of war because it gives them a certain status in the world as insurgents or resistance fighters. Well, if they read the media, they would see that there's no way anything we're going to do is going to give al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and his allies more status than they already have. They are the heroes of the Islamic world. So the whole argument that by treating them as prisoners of war will make them somehow more powerful among Muslims is an insane argument, but one that they stick to very quickly or very strongly. And the other one is just plain, they don't have the moxie to stand up and say, these guys declared war on us, we're going to go get them and we're going to bring them here and treat them as prisoners of war. I think sometimes we give them too much credit for trying to cut corners on the law and to ignore legal things. They're just looking for the easiest way to do things. And that's been my experience for the last 10 years trying to work this program.
Well, I think that's a very valid point. I would suggest that an administration official, if asked the question of, is your purpose nefarious in nature, if you're engaging in extraordinary renditions, why are you engaging in extraordinary renditions except for the reason that you're trying to gain additional intelligence information that you don't think you can gain lawfully under the United States? They would tell you that we have been given assurances that the receiving state is not going to engage in torture because CAT prohibits us from doing that. But CAT doesn't say anything about cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment other than the fact that you have to attempt to prevent SID within your own territorial limits. And who are we to define what that rendering country or the rendered state considers to be SID? That's not our job. That's for the host government to interpret what SID is. So as long as they're not engaging in torture, we're complying with our international obligations. That's the argument that I would make if I was confronted with that question in representing the administration.